company, which is an Oregon company. Same with money.
Okay.
Okay. Well, my company is based on.
Give us your name.
I'm sorry, Carolyn.
For the record.
Carolyn Moran, Living Tree Paper Company. My company is based on using alternative fibers and environmental fibers to make paper. It's an environmental paper company. We use post-consumer waste, recycled office paper. We use hemp, flax, esparto grass for different applications. There's a lot of different properties, different non-woods that are for different papers that we use. Mostly we use hemp and flax for printing and writing grades. Our customers include Nike, Mitsubishi. This particular product here is on every Staples store, on the shelf of every Staples store, and it's in their online catalog, and we're going to be in Office Depot and Office Max. One of our biggest clients right now is Warner Brothers for all the, this is all our coated paper. You guys might want to look at this. It's a very nice print job. You can see what quality paper this is. Contrary to popular belief.
This is Warner Brothers?
These are all Warner Brothers CD booklets that we... This is our biggest client right now. But we've gone from a basically zero cash flow to a multi-million dollar business. And we're dependent on non-wood fibers. That's why we have this business. That's why we're growing, because we have the environmental edge. And hemp is the most popular fiber that people would like us to be using. We use flax probably more than hemp, because we can get flax more easily, but we would prefer to use more hemp. Right now we're importing our pulps from Western Europe. Sometimes we import fibers and pulp them in the United States. We import pulps from China. You know, we're working on building pulping facilities, or like revamping pulping facilities both in North America and Canada. So we're hoping to be able to get some of our hemp from Canada. I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but Oregon used to be the flax seed capital of the country, which is kind of interesting. And basically, hemp has got some of the same growing and, you know, characteristics as flax, so there should be no problem really growing hemp in Oregon. And I would like to see, you know, as far as the future of Oregon, as economic future of Oregon, would be to get a plant that did post-consumer flax, hemp, and straw, because we have so much straw waste that goes, you know, burnt in the fields here.
I want to have you continue telling your story, but you said you're now a multi-million dollar company.
Yeah.
How much money do you spend importing hemp that could be grown here?
Probably quite 10% of what I use. 10% of the pulps that I use is hemp or flax.
Okay.
So 10% of whatever those sales figures are is going to be, you know, it's going to be like literally thousands of tons of hemp and flax at this point, because this is just the beginning. My company is growing really rapidly right now, and I'm having to really project, plan, because it's not a commodity item. You know.
Is your company based in multiple locations or just one? Or
basically, my company's here, but I use multiple mills to make my products. And I'm also working with mills in Europe, mills in the East Coast, mills in Canada. And there's a mill actually in Washington. I'm hoping to get. They're trying to. It like went down, and they're trying to bring it back to do post-consumer and straw pulps. I'm not sure. They're working with the University of Washington. I'm not sure what's going to happen there.
With this Ag and Natural Resources Committee, one of the things that we're interested in is the economy, you know, for the ag industry here. And I guess the figure I'd like you to find, if you don't have it now, get it to us, would be potentially what kind of market there could be for this product, what kind of money could farmers make here.
Oh, yeah.
Just even a guess.
And here the thing is, mine is only part of this market, because there's all these specialty uses for flax and hemp pulp. Like there's, you know, I hate to say this, but cigarette papers, Bible papers, currency. There's all kinds of different uses for flax and hemp that wouldn't be migrated. So there's a huge market that's not even my market. My market's growing to be, I don't know, thousands of tons. But this other market's even bigger, you know. So it's like, you know, there's a big market, and there's like, you know, it's very competitive right now.
How do you pay for it?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Well, Senator Corcoran.
I have a couple of questions. In the testimony from the state police, they assert in the second paragraph that this is a product that is still under research for adverse health effects, has many potential side effects, and has so far been shown to have limited benefit to society. Would you like to comment on that?
What product? Paper?
Hemp.
I don't care to comment on that.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
there's a legitimate concern that this is an attempt at this attempt at legalization of hemp might be a stalking horse for the legalization of marijuana.
That's ridiculous. Have you been to France and Canada and all the places they've been growing it for 30 years?
I won't go to France because they like Jerry Lewis and escargot. But other than that, I have not been to France.
No more French fries.
How about China? Can we get you to go to China for a while?
Okay, how about China? I mean, no.
I'm just trying to address
my first hemp field was in 1995 in France. And I was just, it was just a crop. It was grown and used for all kinds of things, building materials. It just seems ludicrous to me, really, to even compare the two. I've given up on those jokes and everything else, It's just an awesome fiber. It works for a lot of different things, and I need pulp. I need it. I'm going to need more of it. And I'd love to see a facility happen in Oregon that would be a benefit to Oregon economics, because I'm an act local, and sell everywhere kind of person. So, and I'm willing to help that happen if the Oregon wants to get behind it.
Thank you.
Speak to that question.
Yes, go ahead.
My name's Candy Penn. I'm from the Hemp Industries Association. We're a trade group of hemp companies, international but mostly North American. We represent about 200 hemp companies. And in the packet that we presented to you, there is a hemp calendar, and on the cover is a seed crop in France. On the back is a house on the Indian Reservation in South Dakota that's made with roofing materials and hemp cement blocks and hemp cement, which is widely used in France as well. To answer the question, I represent all of these companies that make hemp products. This is a hemp showcase that we circulate around the country. All of these products are currently on the market. We have body care products, textile products, foods, fiber, making paper products, and the building materials. The roofing shingles on this house are made in Canada, Wellington Polymer. Within this calendar, there's a page on January. This is called hemp stone. This is made in Austria. This is hemp plastic. These products are made today out of 100% hemp pressed. No other chemicals used, and it's biodegradable.
Biodegradable chair.
Now, you can put a coating on it that will slow the process down if you want to put it out in the rain. But you wouldn't want to put your drums in the rain.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
So let me try a couple of these arguments that the state police make on you, because you are part of a national group. The stalking horse argument for the legalization of marijuana.
Separate issue. That's what we're trying to educate. Industrial hemp is separate varieties. There's 100 varieties of industrial hemp, which are low THC, non-psychoactive. There's 100 varieties of marijuana, high THC, different plants.
Mr. Chair, if I continue. In the fifth paragraph of the testimony, it says that the belief that this crop would be a source of economic gain to farmers in Oregon is very much in question. Supporters of hemp legalization effort claim hemp cultivation could be profitable for U.S. farmers. However, according to the USDA and the U.S. Department of Commerce, the profitability of industrial hemp is highly uncertain and probably unlikely.
I can only speak to the current market. That's what we're involved in. It's at $200 million right now for North America. Now and we're a baby industry. Just in the beginning stages.
It says here, U.S. total imports of hemp last year were only $1.2 million in a total domestic agricultural market of $202 billion.
I'm aware of the total market sales in finished products, so I'm not aware totally of the ag levels.
Being additive because of the finished
yes,
product.
Sure.
Okay.
And one of the things that everybody wants to see is this value-added process. The farmers can't just grow something these days. They don't make enough money. They've got to add the value to it. So you'll see the farmers in Canada will process the seeds into an oil, or the fiber will be processed into a matting. This is an example of June in the calendar. This is a Mercedes-Benz. These are all parts made out of hemp today. There are 2 million cars on the road today with hemp parts. Hemp matting replaces fiberglass, which is toxic to the workers and non-biodegradable, with the hemp, which is more economic and more beneficial for the environment. And it's stronger and lighter. So Ford, Mercedes, Chrysler, BMW are all adding hemp parts to their cars.
Why don't they say anything about that? I mean,
I think it's still because of the, you know, people still think of it as a drug. I mean, we've been working 10 years to educate people that this is not a drug, but it's so ingrained.
Why doesn't he say anything?
They're stealing them bad enough now without stealing them for smoking, too.
Well, they don't use it in Mercedes isn't telling anybody that the floor mats in the car are made out of hemp, you know.
Right.
And it's kind of because of what Senator Fisher just referred to. He made a joke, but the joke is based on the theory that if people knew that the floor mat was made out of hemp, they'd be smoking the floor mat. When in fact you would have to smoke a truckload of this industrial hemp to try to get high.
To get a headache.
And it would give you a headache and you wouldn't get high.
It's more in the industry level of things. And it's different than that. The reality is they're doing R&D using hemp, flax, and other non-wood fibers for these parts. And it hasn't, you know, they don't want to put it out there because of the competition. And you know, right now it's not like patented, ready to go. It's still at that phase where they're using it. And I know they're doing it with corn, flax, and hemp in the auto industry and some other industries as well. But it's not, you know, it's still that secret kind of industry. It's not like out there yet as far as like, you know, somebody's patenting it and they're using it in their car parts. You know, so there's some other issues going on with economics. But I have a question for you, Senator Clinton.
Sure.
You know, in World War II, we had hemp for victory. There was Agriculture Department put it out there. Everyone was growing hemp. 4-H was growing hemp. What is your opinion of that? I mean, if you're going to compare it to marijuana. I mean, the government doesn't compare it to marijuana, except when they want to compare it to marijuana.
Right.
Their own political uses.
Right. Well, let me answer your question another way. I mean, the purpose of public policy debate is to listen to both sides of an argument, mm-hmm. and I feel that you people are the experts on the hemp industry, mm-hmm. and so I wanted you to have the capacity to address the objections that are raised and hear what your responses are. I actually knew that Oregon was a huge flax producer just from reading Oregon history, and I know that hemp was a well-used product in the history of the country and was a big part of the World War II effort. And because I've known this, you know, fellow to your left for 10 years, and he's educated me on it. Mm-hmm. But I think when you establish a public record, mm-hmm. one of the problems in this process is that when you have a succession of witnesses, often one witness doesn't get to respond to what another witness says, especially if they speak afterwards. And so I wanted you to have the opportunity to set the record straight. I don't agree with the testimony that's in here, but that's not my... I'm not particularly opposed to, you know, legalizing hemp, you know, but I think that it's fair for, you know, the public who has to listen to this debate to listen to reasonable people, knowledgeable people, respond to the yeses and nos on this.
And then another comment I want to make, too, is that I just feel it's a great entrepreneurial, you know, potential. And a lot of people create businesses out of it, and they build the economy, you know, and so money starts to flow again, and why not, you know?
Right. No, we're pretty desperate in the state for economic development, so it's another economic development strategy, in my view.
And the whole country is going into recession, you know?
You know, there's some major corporations that are interested in hemp, like Masonite. They want to make fiberboard out of hemp, but they cannot feasibly do it until it's grown near their processing plants. We can't haul it all over the planet.
And that's an Oregon company. And Pendleton, you're absolutely right. They looked into it, you know, but it wasn't feasible. It's
until we can grow it.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on. Go ahead.
My name's Monty Matthews. I own a company in Eugene called the University Lip Balm Company. And first of all, Chairman Shields and members of the committee, thank you for having us today. I'm not an expert on hemp, but I do listen to my customers. And I've been working with hemp lip balms for about 4 or 5 years and have definitely noticed that people prefer the hemp lip balms over other lip balms. I think the quality that the hemp lip balms bring to people's lips, really people understand just through the feel and the softness and the healing qualities that hemp seed oil has. It makes a difference in which lip balms they choose. I've chosen to go the university route because I've worked with some smaller hemp companies that did produce hemp lip balms, and you could only find them in health food stores. I wanted to bring them to the mass market and found that universities were my best venue to do that.
How old is the company and how much has it grown?
My company is about a year old, and I started off with the University of Oregon back in April, and I've sold about 30,000 tubes.
Wise choice.
And it migrated to Oregon State, and then Washington State, and it's slowly migrating its way east. To answer your question, I'm adding universities virtually every day. My sales are going through the roof right now, and I don't really see an end to it. And my concern is I want to be able to get a hemp seed oil that is the quality hemp seed oil. I think Carolyn made a great point with the economy today. It's a great way to support the farmers here in the state, and I believe in it.
Right now you have to import your hemp seed oil.
My manufacturer imports hemp seed oil from Canada currently.
And I think that you could use the seed for the oil, and you could use rest of plant for paper and building materials from there. Let's be the whole use of the plant. You know, maybe some rotation crops to keep the agriculture in balance.
Mr. Chair, I don't think Senator Fisher is quite correct, because the University of Oregon wouldn't be a natural choice because ducks don't have lips. I think it was a very risky proposition. He took it on, and he was successful, and he should be applauded for that. I didn't know beavers had lips until I saw this stuff.
Is there anybody who wants to try to follow Senator Corcoran's comments?
Mr. Chair, one thing I would mention to you, there has been some interest from wheat farmers in eastern Oregon looking for rotation type of crops, and there is another individual who was not able to be here today from eastern Oregon who has coordinated and worked with some of the farmers, and she has stated to me and to Carolyn that there is a great interest, and it really kind of falls right in place where the question was about the Pendleton Mills. If we had industrial hemp at that time, I believe that it would have been able to be gone through a transition of having industrial hemp moved into that mill site, and you'd have your production of on the ground of the hemp. It could be processed and then moved in, and it could be vertical integrated for the whole process and use of that plant. And I think what we've heard so far today is there's many, many opportunities for the plant to be used in its entirety and actually have less of an impact on the environment at the same time and be productive. One thing I will point out that I think is very unique in this argument that we've heard from the opponents is that they are using the argument that it will not be successful and productive in the sense of profitable. And since when has our government in this state or in this country ever told a farmer that you cannot embark in growing whatever you think may be a viable product based on what they think is going to be the return in the of that product within the market? And that seems kind of disingenuous, because if we're going to do that, I'd say that there'd be other products that the government should be looking at and making those decisions, as compared to trying to limit a commodity that actually was in full production in this country prior to the what I call the misinformation campaign that has been very successful since the 60s.
Chairman, go ahead.
Senator Beyer.
I guess in response to the last statement that Representative Brzezinski made about when has the government told farmers they have to be profitable, actually, the government in Oregon does it all the time through the land use regulations and says if you want to have a commercial building site or a residential building site, you have to be able to grow a commercial product on that farm that is profitable, and you have to meet income tests on that property. So to answer your question, in Oregon it happens all the time. I don't know if it happens that way in other states, but in Oregon it is very, very, I mean, you've got extension agents telling landowners what they can grow if they want to someday qualify for a home on that property.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chair Shields and Senator Beyer, I understand that component, but I would say that the department is not telling the farmer which of those products they could grow to meet that test, as compared to saying that you have to show whatever the profit level formula is as compared to the actual item or commodity that they can or can't grow. It just has to be profitable.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Corcoran.
I mean, the other issue I have to take into that, I mean, I know where Senator Beyer is going with this, and I'm not going to argue with him. It's the $80,000 test. But the other point that does need to be made is that on a federal level, we do a huge subsidization of farm crops, basically to keep those guys afloat. So, I mean, you could envision a day when, you know, there'd be a subsidization of hemp because they were of overproduction. I mean, that's what they do with, you know, milk. That's what they do with other agricultural products. So, you know, I don't think the, you know, the state of the federal government's economic interest in a farming commodity is a relevant topic, because that's basically an interest group issue that gets raised politically. And, you know, I just see this as a another economic development possibility. And it'd be curious to see, in terms of the $80,000 rule, whether hemp as a, you know, as a product would actually, you know, do better than dry wheat farming, or, you know, growing mint, or growing silage corn, you know.
Well, like the farmers in Canada, you do not grow hemp unless you have the contract with where you're going to market it. It's not like grow it and see what we're going to do with it. You know, it's settled beforehand and guaranteed. So that's one thing. But I wanted to speak to a couple other ag issues specifically. One is the weed suppressing ability. It grows so fast that it shades out all other weeds. So a lot of farmers use it just as a rotation crop to get rid of weeds, and it'll even get rid of thistle. I think that you have a lot of that here in Oregon. And the other thing is, it is a detoxifier of soils. If you have any cadmium or other heavy metals and things like that in your soils, there's some great investigation going on in the University of Hawaii as well as in Russia. It totally brings toxins out of the soil and into the plant, and then and the plant somehow changes it so that you don't have that toxicity in the plant. And it thrives on this toxicity. It's very strange. They try it with other plants, and they just die. And the hemp just thrives on it, pulls it out of the soil, and then it's safe to dispose of the plant. So those are just two of the ag issues that they've done research with. It's pretty amazing.
Beware.
Is there another question or another comment that somebody's wanting to make here? Go ahead.
I'd just like to say that in going around to the different universities across the country, and Notre Dame, Miami, Michigan, Tennessee, everybody tends to have jokes about the hemp in the product, but ultimately nobody has ever, it's never detracted from it. Nobody's ever asked me to take it out. Like I said, I'm getting licensed by universities every day. They go through very detailed, and they really research it thoroughly. And I think that if I was to be able to get hemp seed oil here in Oregon, I would definitely consider opening a hemp seed oil lip balm manufacturing plant and doing my part to help the economy here in Oregon. And I think it's important for other hemp companies that aren't represented here too. Oregon could really be on the forefront of any legalizing hemp to be grown, and I think it would make the state not only a stronger state, but a better state.
And I agree with that too. I think that would create the markets. The entrepreneurs, you know, would really create a lot of markets. But, you know, it's gotten to be so difficult for certain levels of products.
Matthews, yours is just a startup company, Monty.
Yes, yes.
And yours is a company started some years ago that's already got multi-million dollar.
Now it does. It's turned the corner the last couple of years, for mm-hmm. sure. Yeah.
A startup and a still relatively small company, one thing, but if, for instance, the auto industry decided they wanted to be able to produce the product here at home rather than having to import it,
yeah,
that would be when you would really turn the corner.
Yeah.
You know. But we still can't get out from under this kind of prejudicial attitude. That's the thing that I see. And Representative Prusansky, you referred to the kind of the campaign, or the propaganda campaign, or the whatever campaign of the '60s. Didn't it start a lot earlier than that?
Well, it actually did. When you look as to what I call the demise of industrial hemp, and it was probably sometime in the 30s with the increase in cotton, as well as in the wood for fiber for pulping, there was a concerted effort of trying to label industrial hemp as marijuana and movement forward. There was a resurgence, and I mean the process of growing industrial hemp was still legal and was legal up until, I believe, in the early 70s when the National Drug Act was passed, and how it actually tied all of strains of marijuana or hemp with marijuana, if I remember correctly. And it was, but it was as the other markets became more, their footing became greater in the production, you saw the reliance on industrial hemp to be going down. The other problem was it did have a distinct disadvantage as to how it was being taken from the fields, dried, and recovered for actual use. And it was at that stage where I think part of the commercialization of industrial hemp really faltered. And so it's been, if you look at the historical perspective, probably over a 30-year period, maybe a 40-year period, that you saw industrial hemp kind of being weaned away and other products taking their place. And the misinformation campaign, I mean, just if you have ever had the opportunity to do any college-level classes on propaganda, it's very interesting when you look at how that theory works in actuality. And I think industrial hemp is a case study of showing how misinformation can be given out and how you can, in fact, label something wrongly as something that it's not, and then basically having the interest groups being able to maintain that approach until the point of where public opinion, as Senator Corcoran says, can in fact be impacted. And that's really what we're doing today, and what we've asked in the past, and what you're seeing around this country, is really trying to re-educate individuals that are in public policy making positions as to why this should not be categorized wrongly. And I believe that the facts do in fact show, and has demonstrated through our own history, how this product has been something that our government has actually embraced and used and encouraged. And then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, we're now seeing it being labeled as something that's has no economic benefit, when in fact we were actually subsidizing farmers to grow it, because it did in fact have a benefit for the war during World War II.
Yeah. Are there any other questions? I'm going to ask you to step back and, you know, I want to say this clearly. I want everybody to hear me. We've had a lot of hearings in here where we've had the room packed and other rooms, and I've always operated on the premise that people of goodwill can have different opinions on subjects, and our purpose is to get to the bottom of the issue.
The sample worked. The CD cover.
Yeah, we want to make sure she gets her CD covers. I thought, well, there was three up here. I don't know where the other one went. Anyway, my point is to say that there are differing opinions, and I want to give everybody a chance, and everybody gets treated with respect. And with that, I do want the other of you from the Oregon State Police. Craig Durbin is here. Sergeant Durbin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
As you know, we've already raised some questions, and I want to understand the perspective that the law enforcement community brings to the issue.
Thank you, sir. Chair Shields and members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I am a sergeant with the Oregon State Police, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Police and also the Oregon Chiefs of Police Association. And we would be in opposition of Senate Bill 672. Some of the concerns have already been raised out of my testimony. One of the issues is that the state would be entering into a dilemma with other states that have legalized hemp farming. And that dilemma is that, in fact, the DEA still does have a zero tolerance for THC levels. In 2001, they had an interpretive ruling saying that any product that would cause a person to ingest THC would be an illegal product. Therefore, the products such as shampoo and creams and lotions, food products or health products, by DEA rule, would be illegal. That does cause a substantial problem with the marketability of these products in the United States, and that's one of the issues that's causing Health Canada, the European Union, and those areas to not have the product that they thought or the marketability that they thought when they first established hemp farming. And I'll talk about that in just a few minutes. There's also a legitimate concern by law enforcement that, in fact, this is a stalking horse for the legalization of drugs. I don't believe that that's brought about just by law enforcement's concerns. If, in fact, you go to the Internet or you go out into the illicit community of drugs, they will tell you that if we have the ability to bring this in and get this legalized, that the view of the public will be less towards the legalization of marijuana overall. And in fact, in my attachments that I've included in your paperwork, there's actual documentation of that by the proponents of the legalization of drugs themselves. If you type in hemp on the Internet, you'll be directed to many sites that will include marijuana and hemp together. And they're very open about it, they're very adamant about it, and they continue to try to bring that out as an issue. And that's all I'd like to say about that. With flax linen and hemp, right now, because of the production facilities, it is more costly to produce hemp, and it's about $15 per square yard in the United States, as opposed to the finest flax linen, which is about $7.50 per square yard. In fact, Pulp and Paper International, which is a trade magazine, puts a break-even price for raw hemp production at about $630 per ton, where newsprint is $500 per ton. There was a study in Vermont that looked at crops and the cost competitive comparison, and what they found was the projections were about $101 per acre for the best case scenario in hemp, $212 for hay, and $525 for corn. Also, the Oregon State University did a study on hemp production. And what they found was that in Oregon that we'd have to have substantial irrigation in order to grow hemp. Because of that, it would put it at a very high cost to grow hemp, and that they would have to have high yields in order to be competitive with China, with Canada, with the European Union. That they'd have to really have substantially high yields in order to be competitive with those countries. In 1999, now this is an old figure, I don't see anything that I've researched that would substantiate that it's any better right now, but in 1999 the report calculates that the U.S. imports of hemp fiber, yarn, and seed could have been grown on less than 5,000 acres total in the United States. If we look at Canada and what's going on in Canada, I've been in contact with Health Canada, done a lot of research from their statistics up there. In Canada, farmers found it very difficult in 1998 to sell the crop that they had up there. In 1999, there was 540 Canadian farmers, and there was 35,000 acres of hemp. About 18,700 of those acres were contracted out to a company called Consolidated Growers. Consolidated Growers went bankrupt because they did not have the market that they thought they were going to have, which left about 232 Canadian farmers with about $5 to $6 million holding the bag. They were not paid $5 to $6 million for their crops, and most of that crop is still being stored up in Canada right now. In 2000, it went down to 13,500 acres. In 2002, right now, the last statistics was 3,850 acres. That's down from 35,000 acres. And they're also down from 232 farmers to 174. And they talk about that because of the lack of marketability, there's less and less licenses up there and less of the product being grown. The budget for Health Canada to maintain the hemp program involves monitoring and inspection, licensing and regulatory issues, and is approximately $500,000 per year to maintain the program. That includes a full-time personnel of 3 and an additional need for 5 to 6. They said they need about 5 to 6 more personnel in their program for all the things that they do just to maintain 174 farmers and 3,850 acres. When they go out into the field and they sample these crops, what they'll do is they take a relative sample, 60 of them per crop, they throw out 30 and they test 30. The budget for the testing of those crops on those samples at 3,000 acres was around $60,000. And that does not include the inspection of the production facilities themselves. The other large concern that they're finding is, and this is through Health Canada, when they do a risk analysis based on the cannabinoids and the THCs, there is approximately 60 cannabinoids in THC. Of those 60, there is only 3 that have been widely studied. So that would leave 57 that are unstudied. They really don't know what harmful effects that there might be. Now, in the products themselves, there is a slight THC content as far as the health creams and those type of products. The in-depth risk analysis done by Health Canada, now the newest one is not out. They're still in the process. They thought that would have been out the first of this year. It is not out. I've spoke to people up there. They said that they do not believe that there's going to be much deviation in the last risk analysis, but they quoted in that risk analysis that on the basis of currently available data, that new food products and cosmetics made from hemp pose an unacceptable risk to the health of consumers. It also says that hemp products may not be safe because even small amounts of THC may cause developmental problems. In Europe, they've actually cut back on their subsidy of the hemp farmers. And the reason they've done that is because what they found was that the subsidies were going up, but the production was going down. And so they believe people were growing crops just for the subsidy themselves. So they've cut back on their subsidy. They've also cut back on the percentage of THC allowable in the plants from 0.3 down to 0.2 because of concerns. So based on this information, we have many questions. Some of the questions would be, what would be the provisions for testing that would be put into place to assure that these products made in Oregon would not create a liability to the state of Oregon? What provisions are put in place to ensure that the inspection and testing of crops, and who would be required to pay for the testing of those crops? Who would be required to test those samples? If it is the Department of Agriculture, where would those samples be tested? How the inspection of the seed and processing facilities would be implemented, and who would be required to do those? And how would the Department of Agriculture detain or seize a crop that by federal law would be a controlled substance if in fact it was over the 1% level? And what would be put into place as security for that crop until it was destroyed? How would this destruction take place? In conclusion of my testimony, I would think that there are many consequences of doing this, and that would be creating a law that was in direct conflict with federal law, creating a significant obstacle for law enforcement to investigate and obtain probable cause search warrants in the manufacturing of illegal marijuana. There has been testimony here that this plant would be grown different in crops. That is true if, in fact, they do not grow it in the rows themselves. But if they do grow it in the rows themselves, then it's almost going to be impossible to differentiate between a hemp product and a marijuana product from the air. So in order to attain that probable cause, it's going to make it next to impossible to get probable cause to go onto that property to inspect that. That would be found, I guess, through the Ag Department if they went out and actually inspected the crop. Legalizing the production of a product that to this date has not been proved to be completely safe for human consumption or use, and creating a very complex and costly program that will require very close and intensive monitoring. In this bill, they talk that it's 1% THC allowable. That is a concern because up in Health Canada and the EU, Health Canada allows 0.3%, and the EU allows 0.2%. So in the stalks themselves, usually with the seeds that would be grown for industrial hemp, you are well below a 1%, if any, in the stalk itself. The issue that you have is within the flowers and within the leaves. The leaves are where you need to be testing. The flowers are where you need to be testing, also within the stalks. But you need to make sure that the THC content is tested in those areas as well as the stock itself. And this concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the information. I certainly, having received it just a few minutes ago, haven't read through the several pages that you've got. I do have a couple questions. As I understood it, when you grow industrial hemp in rows, those rows are fairly tight, and you're talking about aerial surveillance. But if you put a marijuana plant in a row that is grown tightly together and you want stalks, you don't get the broad leaves that you need for the marijuana itself, and the stalks, the male industrial hemp plants would cross-pollinate with this marijuana plant that you're trying to hide in the middle of the field and would radically lower the THC or whatever letters you used. I'm not even familiar. I'm so far removed from this stuff that I don't know even the lingo. How would you do that? I mean, if you follow what I'm saying, I'm just raising a question about the possibility that you assert of actually using a field of industrial hemp to hide a marijuana plant or a bunch of marijuana plants.
Senator Shields, that is correct. If a person was to attempt to grow an actual marijuana for consumption within this field of industrial hemp, it'd be a poor choice to do that. The issue with law enforcement is back to the probable cause standard. We would find it very difficult to go into a field for inspection other than a consent theory with that person that is growing, because if a person has an industrial hemp license and they have that registered, if we were to someone was to come to us and say that that person is in fact growing marijuana, we would have very great difficulty in obtaining probable cause short of somebody that actually went in there that wanted to give us information saying that they saw it, that they knew the difference between the plants, that there was in fact buds on those plants and those type of things. It's just going to create an issue where it's going to make it very difficult to get that probable cause standard if in fact someone wants to attempt to circumvent the law. Now, would it be a poor choice for them to do that? Yes, it would be a poor choice, because typically in the cross-pollinization of what you've been talking about, the female plant is what the grower is after.
The marijuana grower.
Yes, sir. They want the female plant, and what happens is that these male plants will cross-pollinate and cause that female plant to become a male plant, which in turn, then it has seeds and is not very marketable. Will it still have a THC content and allow you to have the effects of the euphoria and the high off of the THC? Yes, it will. In fact, 1% THC, you can do that. First-time users on 1% THC can get the euphoria. In fact, there's been studies that down to 0.8% that there still is an euphoric high off of marijuana now, or the hemp plant, if you were to call it a hemp plant, because it would have 1% THC content that you're allowing for. So could you get a euphoria off of that if you were to ingest it? Yes, you could. Would it be a long-time user? Would they have euphoria off of it? It depends on how much that they use. They might have to use a lot, but yes, they could.
I would like to ask Representative Prezansky, if he'd come up and the two of you sit down for a minute, because I just,
sure.
I'm trying to understand, you know, in every hearing I've had, I've tried to have an honest dialogue, and usually it's easiest when I quote-unquote don't have a dog in the fight. On Monday this week, I sat here for 4 hours listening to the Farm Bureau on one side and the Seed Commission on the other side, and they were all farmers, and they were talking about different things about the commodity commissions. And I just tried to do it very fair and very balanced, and that's what I'm trying for here. With that said, Representative Prezansky, how do you respond to what was just said? I mean, as logically and calmly as you can.
we'll be pretty calm. Senator Chair Shields and committee members, I guess in the sense that if you're looking at probable cause as a prosecuting attorney, I would be able to get a warrant issued based on what Sergeant Duran has stated. I mean, if you had an individual that came to law enforcement and said, I believe that this individual is growing marijuana in this hemp field, and gave the information that he stated that they had knowledge of, that's basically how they get informants, that someone that's reliable in giving information has been trustworthy, and then they present it to a judge, and the judge makes that determination. So I think they could get that. I mean, clearly what you will have in this perspective, and I mean, this is the whole part, how many farmers are going to put their farm equipment that cost anywhere from $20,000 to $100,000 for one piece of equipment, plus their farm, at risk to attempt to grow what apparently would be, in what the sergeant has said, low-grade marijuana, as compared to growing the product that they've contracted with some producer or someone who wants the hemp? I just don't see it. I mean, I think the laws that we have in place will, in fact, keep that from occurring. And even if it doesn't, I do believe there are the safeguards through the Ag Department of Ag doing field tests, and they would actually know the difference in how the marijuana is grown as compared to hemp is grown, and would be able to make those findings, and those individuals would in fact be in violation of their license under the Ag. Regarding the other components, I mean, it really comes back to what we had said earlier. We have the claim that our state one should not move forward because the feds say we can't. I thought the 10th Amendment gives state rights. And I do believe that this is an issue, that if we believe that this is something that would be productive for our state, that we should in fact go on record, and as other states have done in this country, such as North Dakota.
Let me interrupt you. How many states have, to use your phrase, quote unquote, gone on record?
There's probably about a dozen that have gone on record as to looking at either research for the economic benefit of industrial hemp in their state, or actually have made provisions for it being produced. I believe, and I'd have to ask Candy Penn to come back up, but I believe North Dakota is the only state at this point that has actually voted for the outright production of industrial hemp within its borders. And Hawaii. Okay, Hawaii at one point was research. I know that, but...
They're in their fourth year production of the University of Hawaii.
Okay.
With the DEA license.
And so, and it's quite interesting. I mean, again, the DEA has taken a position, and they have somehow categorized. I mean, here's what I would think is somewhat pretty asinine from the perspective of where DEA has done. There's about 2 years back, they basically stopped all bird seed coming in from Canada because it had hemp seed in there. And it's all, I mean, we've had bird seed imported in this country with hemp seed for decades. And all of a sudden, it's like, we can't allow it in because we got a trace amount of THC in this bird seed, and we're afraid, or we believe, that somehow people are going to take that, or we're going to take some other product, health shampoo or whatever, and somehow disseminate it, cook it down to get to a point where you get a level of THC to get high. I just don't see the rationale for that that philosophy, and I really personally believe we're doing a disservice to our kids by continuing to have that approach to our drug laws. I mean, when you somehow loop and put in place that industrial hemp is somehow going to cause people to get high, have this euphoric effect by using lip balm on their lips, which I've been using for decades, and that hemp for the last 10 years, I think you send out the wrong message to our kids, and then they say, well, this didn't do it, so let me try something else that they said it's bad for me. I think we're approaching, and this is where I really don't want to go in this hearing, because this is exactly what I call the attempt to really cloud and move away from the real issue. And again, how is our country today claiming that industrial hemp is not economic, is not valuable, when we actually were using it and promoting it and subsidizing it back in the 40s. And it has been, in fact, a viable crop. And clearly, it may be more costly to utilize industrial hemp today than it was, and when you look at the cost back in the 40s, just because it is a niche industry today as compared to being a outright industry in full production. I believe, as what we've heard from Carolyn Moran, as well as Monty Matthews, people who are actually using hemp seed oil or using hemp fiber, that if you do in fact allow it to have the opportunity to reestablish itself, those costs will in fact come down because there will be higher demand, supply will be in greater need, and the supply and demand of our economics will in fact cause the cost of production to go down.
I wanted to give Craig a chance to respond, but first, Senator Beyer had a question that I want him to have a chance to ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Brzezinski, I'm just looking at calendar that you provided for us in the state legislation. There's somewhat of a summary of what the different states have done. And I see most of them look like they are a study, university study for feasibility. And I was wondering if you or if anyone could provide any of these studies to us, the feasibility studies I assume these universities have done in these states about the growing of hemp in their state, and it would be very helpful if you could provide, if they're available to us, the feasibility studies about the growing of hemp.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, I'll do my best. That material that you're referring to actually came from Candy Penn, and I'll ask her for her assistance. Now, one of Daryl Engelering, I believe, who is the researcher at OSU, he was not able to be here today, and what the sergeant has testified to as to some of the issues that he raised is, in fact, a study that was done by OSU at the request of ONRC, if I'm not mistaken, as to the need for irrigation for the crops, depending on where they would be grown within the state. I'll do my best to get whatever studies made that are actually that have been actually produced. I would assume that in some of these studies that they may not have anything to date, just because that they're currently still in that process.
Thank you.
Thank you. While you're at it, I noticed that a couple different states are looking at the biofuel issue, and maybe Candy or somebody else can tell us, is this biofuel going to produce more than corn, for instance, you know, because we're always thinking about, we're always thinking about markets and stuff. So that'd be another interesting question to come back to us with.
And Chairman Shields, I can tell you that biofuels, there's actually two companies, I believe, in the state of Oregon that are actually using biofuels, and they're, one of them is out of Eugene, that's actually in production now. It's coming out of Iowa. That's where the actual production is. Representative Kropp and his ag committee has two or three bio bills, fuel bills, that are in his committee today. Jeremy Erling from my office has done research on that, and he could probably come up and give some more information. I can tell you that I have actually seen a bus that Woody Harrelson owns that is actually he used in a promotional that started in Washington State and went to various universities down basically the I-5 corridor, stopping the University of Oregon where I saw it, that was actually being fueled and ran on biofuels that were with hemp.
You have to come up.
You'd have to come back up. But while she's sitting down, I want to give Craig a chance to respond to some of the other comments. Craig, I kind of just read people's body language, and I noticed that you were making some notes at that point. Is there some reaction that you had?
That's correct, Senator Shields. And I would ask the person that knew about Hawaii to respond, but the last research that I did with Hawaii, in fact, they were growing it, but because of DEA regulations, that they were required to fence it, put surveillance on it, and infrared. That's the problem that these other states are running into because of the DEA regulations and rulings on the THC content, is that this is a controlled product and that they're putting the regulations on it. As to the THC, the problem that we have with probable cause is that if I have an informant, he was to go into a field and say that there is a marijuana plant in there, I would have to prove in my affidavit that in fact, that there was greater than 1% THC content in that plant. That, short of being able to test the plant, having the informant go in there, test the plant, it's going to be very, I'm not going to be able to establish that it is not allowable under this bill to grow that plant and gain the probable cause for the warrant.
Well, let me understand this. I mean, I'm not real bright, okay? But if this is industrial hemp and it's long stalks and skinny, and in the middle of a field you had one that wasn't this tall but half this height and was big and wide and leafy, why couldn't you just visually see the difference rather than having to test the difference? Wouldn't the visual be enough? I'm really struggling with that.
And Representative Przanski, being a lawyer, would be able to talk about this probably more than I, but the plan itself, as far as the visualization of the plan, in a court of law, an officer can go in and through training and experience, based on plants being tested within the crime lab and coming back to the affirmative and his training experience based on that, can go into a court of law and say, in fact, what he sees is illegal marijuana or controlled substance. An informant going into that crop, if he was to see a plant that was tall and skinny, but it's a plant that maybe he knows that is being, that their sample is being taken off of that for personal use, we're going to have to show in a court of law that plant is greater than the THC than what is being allowed under this bill in order to obtain a search warrant and go in. But that it is an issue. It's an issue with law enforcement that we're concerned about. It's an issue because of the probable cause standard that we would have to be able to show. Again, getting back to the point of somebody doing that in the setting that you're talking about, it would be a very poor choice, but it is an issue that we're concerned about. The marketability of the plant, just because of the DEA with the regulatory scheme that they have right now with THC content, is very much in question. It's going to make it very difficult, as we've already talked about, with Canada and with the EU and those countries finding that it's very difficult because the market is not that great.
Well, you raise an interesting question now, and I'm going to just throw this out. And you guys may think I'm really out to lunch on this one. But Canada, the European Union, China, and others have been raising hemp for a long time, and they do it based on markets. And your illustration from Canada is that the market didn't pan out, partly because the United States is such a big economy, and they built their market on the idea that he'd probably be able to sell it to the United States and couldn't. Representative Przanski has raised the issue of states' rights, but I'd raise a different issue. In our world of interconnectedness with NAFTA and WTO and so on, isn't there a sense in which Canada or the European Union could raise the issue of restraint of trade? I mean, nobody's maybe thought of that, but I've heard comments around this building even that some of the states' rights issues could become real sticky around states' rights running headlong into conflict with restraint of trade issues. And I don't know if anybody wants to comment on that, but, I mean, it's a legal issue. That's why I'm looking at the lawyer, but you're welcome to comment if you want.
Well, there's a company in Canada that's taking up a NAFTA issue on this. They went bankrupt, basically, because some of the rules and regulations of the United States, and they are taking up a NAFTA issue, but it's very expensive, the whole process. So it makes it difficult to actually really get it into the courtroom, you know, because it's like, you know, barring trade on their from their company, and it caused them to that part of their industry to go down the tubes.
Mr. Chair, I think you raise a significant point because, I mean, a number of us who do not agree with such as NAFTA or WTO because of the impact it does, in fact, have on your local jurisdictions of being able to have additional regulations and safeguards. And I think one of the areas is organics. When you look at what this state has in place and what it's worked for, there has been some claims that maybe what we have in the way of our regulations are barriers to other countries that want to come in and not be at the same level, and we shouldn't be able to regulate or at least identify those commodities as being different from where to the level that we believe is appropriate.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying here is if it's good for the goose, it's got to be good for the gander.
I hear you.
And if you can have companies overseas or NAFTA or WTO saying, hey, you've got too many restrictions in Oregon on something grown organically or whatever, you can't do that, that's restraint of trade. Why isn't it also a restraint of trade if somebody in Canada is growing a product and our regulations are putting them out of business?
And that's what I think Ms. Moran has basically alluded to, is that you are seeing those type of challenges. I mean, as you can imagine, using the legal system takes time and money. Okay. And so the question is, you know, what is the process for that to occur? And these are through basically almost like world court type of settings. And so besides those two hurdles, you also have the political hurdle that has to be overcome. And, you know, again, I think it's one of those things that what we're asking is that for you to look at this as a commodity, as something that could in fact be used and rightfully. And if, let's just say, all it would take is a stroke of a pen from the President of the United States to do an executive order to override what DEA has in place now, or legislation at the federal level to actually say it is an agricultural crop to be allowed to have the same non-restraints as other commodities that are grown in this country. And the question is, are we going to be in a position to let's say jump on the front of the wagon in being able to position ourselves for the future? I think some of the states that have actually gone to the effort through their policies making process and has given the green light for within their states are going to be better positioned than those states that haven't. And since we are still meeting every other year as a body for making public policy, where are we going to be if it happens in the even years versus the odd years? And I would just say, if you believe that this is, as a committee in 1999 felt it was, something that should be brought forward, we're asking you to support it and let the state go on record as one other state, as the other states have, to be in support of allowing for industrial hemp to be grown in its borders, and then allow the state and other states to fight the policy decisions that have been made at the federal level, and then we ourselves will be on record as to, I think, supporting farmers to be able to have the opportunity, if they deem appropriate, to go into production, knowing that, as any ag product, there's always going to be a risk. Do you have a market for whatever that product is?
Right.
And I only came up to comment on the biodiesel. I'm driving a biodiesel.
For the record, your name again.
Oh, I'm sorry, Carolyn Moran.
You're driving a biodiesel, but it's not...
it's not hemp, but I mean, it could be made from hemp oil, and that would sort of eliminate the THC problem, because you wouldn't be ingesting it, would go into your car, you know, so you wouldn't have these health issues or these testing issues or whatever it is. If it just turned into a refined biodiesel, no one's going to drink it, you know, it's definitely... So I was just going to support that as a very positive new industry.
Yeah, okay. Craig, other comments that you wanted to make?
No, Senator Schultz.
Yeah. One of the things that occurs to me, I mean, Arizona, I'm not sure I catch all the Illinois, Montana, North Dakota, Virginia. These aren't exactly radical states. I mean, you know, I don't think they keep up with Oregon, and all of these states have done something, urging Congress to promote or assist, or urging DEA, Department of Agriculture, and Congress to reconsider federal policies, et cetera, et cetera. this is not a radical step, and so I'm having a hard time wondering where this comes from. Does it come from a long time of prejudice? Is the concern based scientifically, or is it based more in our prejudice in our past? And Craig, even as you spoke, I was thinking, you have very good testimony. Is the testimony kind of based on, you know, the position that this is against the law and we've got to get the supportive evidence in place? Or is it based on, you know, if this were not, say we roll the calendar back to 1938 when Popular Mechanics up here was promoting this new $1 billion crop, and in 1938 I guess $1 billion was worth something. Popular Mechanics, if we were rolled a clock back to that time, what kind of testimony would you be doing then? You know what I'm saying? It's not, I mean, your testimony began with, this is against the law, and I commend you for doing testimony that talked about the economics and everything else of it, but I'm wondering what the testimony would be at that point. And part of the reason I do that is because I had a conversation with my own sheriff in back of my county, and he was trying to get outside of the box, trying to think not just the police agencies are and have been against this because they see it as a cover for marijuana and so on. And he ended up saying, you know, if you had good surveillance, if you had fields that were out in the open, if you had fields that were registered, if you had fields where we could fly over any time, that ought to make a difference. And so I guess I'm asking you to kind of respond. Am I out to lunch here? I guess it's getting close. You want to comment for a minute?
I would say, first of all, Senator Shields, members of the committee, that yes, we do have to take the position that by federal standards, it is still a controlled substance, and it is controlled, and it's against the law. So we do have to take that stand. I think it's very difficult to excise hemp away from marijuana. I think that's the issue. The issue is that we have marijuana and we have hemp, but they're combined together. We don't have a crop as it stands right now that is engineered to separate those two and take THC out of the picture, and to take the comparison out of the picture. That's the issue. It's very difficult. We as adults sometimes can excise that in our own mind and thought process and take that away. But it's very difficult when we're talking about people that maybe aren't so educated, people that the youth and those type of persons, to say it's totally two separate issues. For us, the picture is still the picture, and it's very difficult to separate the two. If we had a crop, and I've know of people that have tried to engineer the plant itself for more illicit purposes, more than anything, and we're talking about marijuana grows. If somebody could come up with a crop that would take THC out of the picture and change the look of the plant, then, you know, that's it might be a different story. But it's really difficult to separate the two. It's really difficult for me as a law enforcement personnel when I go out there and give talks for drug abuse, for anti-drug talks to the youth, to high schools, those type. They don't separate the two. They look at the two together. And I think the problem is...
Isn't that a societal prejudice rather than, you know...
I think
because we've had 30, 40 years of building a prejudice rather than...
I don't know if it's so much as... yes, I think there is that component. But I also think it's promulgated by the illicit culture itself. Because, again, if you go on to High Times, if you go on to Hemp Nation, you go to any of those websites, they're going to very blatantly, very openly talk about marijuana. They're going to direct you to books about marijuana growing. They're going to direct you to books about pipes and bongs and all those type of things. So that's the culture that the youth are in. And when they see hemp and the persons in that culture talking about, let's get hemp so that we can get the legalization of marijuana, they promulgate that argument themselves.
Yeah.
So they're making it very difficult to separate.
So what they're doing is a real disservice then to anybody that would want to raise legitimate industrial hemp.
That's correct. And so for us as law enforcement...
To change that culture would be a tremendous undertaking.
It would be.
Yep. Is there anybody else today that wants to do any testimony? Anybody that didn't get a chance? Or?
Okay.
Floyd, excuse me.
That's fine.
Representative Przanski. Representative Wells had this hearing before the Ag Committee in 99 on the House side.
That's correct.
Were there a majority of the members of the committee ready to pass something to the floor that the Speaker did not want to go to the floor?
Absolutely. I did a vote count of the members. I had more Republican members that were going to vote the bill out. One individual Democrat representative told me that he wanted to vote for it, but he was afraid that it would make him look like he was soft on crime, and he felt that he couldn't do that. We had the actual vote count. I took it back to Representative Wells at the time. He acknowledged that, and he said basically that he couldn't do that. He told me going into the hearing that he could give me a hearing, but he would not at that point be able to do a work session unless he got approval from the Speaker. And Speaker Snodgrass and I actually had a heart-to-heart talk in my office in the evening after, and it was as we're getting closer and closer to the deadline that bills had to move, and she told me that she did not think it was the right time, that I should continue to try to educate Oregonians and members of the body, and that maybe sometime in the future it would be more appropriate to allow the hearing to actually go to a work session and have that vote. And I think she even, well, I can't speak for her. I can only interpret what she was telling me is that I think she understood, as many other individuals did in that process, that there is a difference, and that the concern is that that belief that if you somehow allow industrial hemp to be standalone, that because of how many different organizations, the pro-marijuana side, the pro-law enforcement side, have grouped these things together, that they have, in fact, as I think all of us will agree, has made a disservice, that she felt that it was people were not knowledgeable enough to be able to distinguish between the two. We believe that this is one of the ways that we can actually move this forward by actually having it be recognized for what it is, a viable crop that can, in fact, be legitimately grown without having the effects. And I mean, if law enforcement, and I don't want to put the sergeant on the spot now, but if the concern is the level of the THC that's called for this in the bill is 1%, and we're going to go to a lower standard that like the EU has, we're more than willing to do that. The reason we had it at 1% is because we believe, knowing that it's going to have to be something reintroduced to this country, that we wanted to have an acceptable level for the production as it was refined into the point of where it could, in fact, if necessary, or found to be not necessary to be at 1%, that it could, in fact, be less, that it should be, and it could be. What we've talked, the individuals I spoke with back in 97 through 99, they felt that in the need to have some flexibility, and I understand what the sergeant has relied on is the evidence that he's been able to gather and what has come from other law enforcement components in the country, believe that that might be too high of a level for THC, the percentage. Again, we're more than willing to work with him if that's something that he would be willing to do. But I also understand there's other concerns that he's raised. And so I think we're going to have to agree to disagree, I think, respectfully, and understand that these are policy decisions that your committee now is being asked to make. And we believe, for the reasons we present, that it is workable. And there are studies that I can bring in to show that the 1% is not something that is of grave concern as a something that's euphoric as to stimulating high that's come out of studies, I believe, out of the state of Tennessee. So, I mean, it's one of those policy things.
Just a quick question, and we're going to wrap this up in a few minutes, but when Craig gave his testimony, he said Canada was 0.3 and Europe's 0.2 and we're 0.1 or whatever. Obviously, you can have different strains or whatever that have different THC levels. Have we ever approached one, as Craig was mentioning, that would have none at all or be at almost zero or something like that? I mean, maybe you're saying 0.1 is almost at zero. I don't know.
But the trace amounts, I mean, that's the thing, is how you define that as to what you're looking for. I would say, based on the information I've received, I've not looked at the studies that DEA has commissioned to have done as to what the different levels are to get different highs. And as to what is or isn't acceptable, they've now taken a position of zero tolerance. Any trace is not acceptable, because under the definition they are interpreting under federal law, any trace is illegal. Jeremy has a few things to say. I will, if he's not going to say it, we have beer that's sold on the market as non-alcoholic beer. It does, in fact, have a very low percentage of alcohol in it. We have mouthwash that has a lot of alcohol in it. We don't see us regulating that and concerned that kids are going to be going out and getting drunk on Listerine or whatever else it may be. Then you have nutmeg that actually has psychoactive components to it. There are things, I mean, to me, that's the extreme, that's the argument that's being brought forward as compared to looking at it on a more reasonable, sensible basis. Yes, we acknowledge there is some level of THC. Is it reasonable to believe, as I've heard, when the fields were grown for during the war effort, a lot of it was in the Midwest, you still have wild industrial hemp being is produced, but because it's wild, it's a weed. I mean, that's the bottom line. And from the individuals I've spoken with who grew up in those areas, they said that if they attempted to use that to get a euphoric high, they got a headache and they got sick. And so, yeah, it does have a trace amount, and I can't tell you what the percentage of that was or what it is today. And maybe some of these studies that have been asked for will have some of that information. But the reality is it's not providing the level of high that people apparently are looking for with marijuana.
Well, before you get there, you get such a headache that you're not happy with getting high anymore. I do want to mention, when you mentioned mouthwash, in my 30 years as a clergyman, I had one alcoholic who talked about drinking mouthwash when he couldn't get a hold of anything else to drink.
Terrible
advice.
Sounds
like a pretty destructive way to get drunk. Jeremy, you had a couple comments.
Yeah, Chair Shields, you mentioned, you asked what the lowest level of a strain was that's currently growing. I know of one in Russia at the 0.06% THC level. That's the lowest I've been able to find. I just wanted to touch upon a few things that have been mentioned. There's a company called Orincon, which produces some sort of device that's able to detect marijuana and distinguish it from hemp from an aerial surveillance perspective.
Okay.
So it is possible to do it other than by taking samples. I wanted to just kind of bring that to your attention. Also, as Sergeant Durbin mentioned, there are only 3 studied out of about 50 cannabinoids within hemp or marijuana. And one of those is CBD, and I thought this was just interesting in that CBD counteracts the effects of THC at a 2-to-1 ratio. So if it's found, if we're using 1%, so say there's a 1% THC in industrial hemp and 2% of this CBD in industrial hemp, that would counteract any of the psychoactive high that you would get from smoking the industrial hemp. And typically, you would find CBD ratios to be about 5-to-1 in industrial hemp, and it's 2-to-1 in which that effect would occur. So when you're smoking industrial hemp, you're not going to add on, you're not going to get more THC by smoking more industrial hemp. What you're going to be doing is getting more CBD, and that's why you're getting the headaches and you're not going to get high.
Don't speak like too much of an expert on that.
He's done all the research.
Okay. Are there any other questions? I appreciate the hearing this morning. I've learned a great deal. I just don't know how we're going to get a whole lot of other people. Craig, did you have something you wanted to say?
Senator Shields, members of the committee, I was just going to point to, in the attachments, what Representative Brzezinski talked about, there is an article here about the ditch weed, the weed that's growing in, especially in Wisconsin. They did an article in there, so you'll be able to look at that and get some more information on that.
Okay. Well, like with so many hearings, I've ended up with more homework for the weekend. It seems to be what I'm always doing. Thank you for your indulgences today, and with that, I'm going to adjourn the committee.